Hey there. I'm Bianca Stone, and you're listening to the Ruth Stonehouse Podcast. Today we're listening to a Q&A recording between poets Mark Wunderlich and Chantalie Gander, moderated by myself, from the opening night at the Ruth Stonehouse's Next Galaxy Writing Retreat at Blueberry Hill Inn that happened just a couple of weeks ago and was such a roaring success. Please enjoy this recording.
All right, everybody, we're slowly making our way back to our seats, or back to our quiet voices. Awesome. Well, I am thrilled to be sitting between two amazing poets and talking to them a little bit about their poetry, their process, their lives. And I want to start by asking a little bit of the context of how you found your place in the poetry world. Here we are at a writing retreat where I'm hoping that people here are going to have a creatively life-changing experience where a turn happens in their writing and they start to really develop their sense of place in their writing practice. Is there a time, can you tell me a little bit about each of you, about your early life as a writer, and were there certain, can you pinpoint certain experiences, certain teachers, certain programs or certain experiences that really shaped your, and sent you out on your way as to get you where you are now? Mark, I'll start with you.
Yes, there are many, you know, the subject of the education of the poet is always a really interesting one, because what you're often thinking about is how is it that you have become a kind of whole person or something, you know, and poetry is this peculiar pursuit, because it's sort of, we make it out of our own subjectivity. Right, it's both the product of our, it's the product of you know, where we grew up and our earliest relationship to language, how we were educated, who you know, if someone did someone read to you when you were young, you know, I mean, these kinds of things, and so part of it is like what you inherited, right? Like what are the circumstances in which you found your way into the world, and then the other thing is, then what did you make of that? You know, then what choices did you make when you had choices to move yourself along in the world, and you know, and who helped you, right? Like who was there, who taught you and helped you, and what did you learn from you know, good education? What did you learn from bad education? What did you learn from like the terrible teacher? What did you learn from those life changing amazing teachers? I think like many people, I had some very good luck by having some good early teachers. You know, I mean, I can think of many kind of along the way. That I became a poet is a surprise to me. I was not a precocious child writing verses, you know, like, and showing them to someone who was quite, I grew up in a house that didn't have a lot of books in it. Mm-hmm. You know, I grew up in a very rural, you know, in a place where like the bookmobile came twice a month in the summer, and it was a dilemma because you could only check out six, right? And like I needed to get a note from the school librarian saying I could check out 10 books, you know, because I knew I was going to, like, 2 weeks is so long. I was going to get through all of these books, and what was I going to do? So, you know, I loved to read certainly as a kid, but in college, I thought that an education was about getting a job. Mm-hmm. I thought that it had to have this practical application. That's why you went to school, is so that you could get then to amass some sort of expertise, and then you used that to work. And I didn't really understand this notion of like education as the kind of building of a person, as this sort of building of a complete person. No, that I didn't know anyone who lived in the world that way. So there was no antecedent for me, and it took me a while to kind of understand. There was this crucial point when I was in college. I was studying foreign languages because I liked them, but I thought what I was going to do is like, what do you do? Do you become a translator? What do you do? And at that point in the 80s, the CIA and the U.S. military were recruiting people who were studying German, Russian, and Chinese. Mm-hmm. And I went through the interview process with the CIA and one with the U.S. military who were doing recruiting when I was like a junior in college. And I thought that I was going to go to the Language Institute in San Diego, and I thought I was going to like rapidly learn Russian. And I thought essentially I was going to become a spy. Okay. Like that was going to be the track, because it was like a practical thing. And they were offering not only to pay for the rest of my education as an undergraduate, but for this entire education that you would go through if you sort of signed yourself over to this world. But I also at that point needed an English credit. And this was when you had to go around to the classrooms at the University of Wisconsin, and you would go to a different room to sign up for the class, and I had to get this English credit, and I was signing up for Chaucer, right? I thought, I'll take this Chaucer class. So I like put my name, it's like on the blackboard, and you know, you write it. And I get the card in the mail telling me what my registration was, and the class I was signed up for was Creative Writing 1. Which was next to Chaucer, you know, on the course list, because they were alphabetical. And so I like Creative Writing 1. And I was like, great, you know. And so I showed up on the first day. I thought, all right, well, I'll just go and see what it's like. And I went to this class, and I had a teacher who was one of the fellows at the University of Wisconsin. You know, her name is Lisa Gett, and she was late to class. And we were all sitting around the room, like, silently. And I hear someone walking down the hall. I hear the sound of someone coming down the hall. And it was a very unfamiliar sound at the University of Wisconsin at that point. It was the sound of high heels. Right. And of someone late coming down the hall. And this creature comes into the room. Like, she was wearing all purple. She was, like, wearing all purple. She had on, her winter coat was a cape. She was wearing high heels. She was wearing like these. I was like, I absolutely almost fell off my chair. I was like, who is this glamorous creature who has like come into our lives? And she had gotten this fellowship. She'd been living in Brazil, where she was like translating poems from Portuguese. And she came into the room, and she handed out this poem. And she said, we're going to read this, we're going to talk about it, and then you're going to take it home, and you're going to memorize it, and you're going to come back, and everyone is going to recite this poem. And it was The Snowman by Wallace Stevens.
Wow.
And I, you know, one must have a mind of winter to regard the frost in the boughs of the pine trees crusted with snow, right? You know, as you begin that poem. And I was like, what is this witchcraft? You know, like, who is this person, and what is this thing? And it was really at that moment where I thought, okay, this is the conversation I want to have. Like, this is the conversation I've been waiting to have. And this is about, that poem is so mysterious and so strange, and it just felt like a door was opening, and I needed at that moment to walk through it. Mm. And that's what I did. And at that point, then I thought, okay, how do you do this?
Right.
How do you do this thing? How do you become this thing?
Right.
That's a long answer.
Mm. Oh, it's absolutely fabulous. Yes, yeah. Shanta.
How do I follow that? So, let's see. It was very zigzaggy. So I write prose, and I also do journalism, and they all seem like they don't talk to each other. They do. In my house, I wasn't allowed to really ask questions. Children are to be seen, not heard. So I came to writing as a punishment. true story. And I'll save all the gory details for the memoir. But the writing punishment was like, imagine Bart Simpson, right? So sometimes my mother would give me a sheet of paper and I'm like repeating what I will not do again that I probably will do again, like in a week or later. Yeah. So doing that, and then I had a sixth grade teacher who would assign dictionary pages. And so what? Pomade and pomegranate. It was in the peas. I remember it. And so for saying the word shut up. And
what, you had to write out?
You write out the dictionary pages, which created a black market.
Awesome to me now.
Assign me to the dictionary pages now, please. So I kind of figured out that writing could be a way to talk to the page as opposed to all these adult people that were coming in on my life who I could not talk to. I didn't necessarily have any like traditional grooming or anything like that. Like I was read to, but it's not like, some, you know, I was 8 years old when I realized, oh, I too could put together a poetry book. Like I feel like I came late to the party. So in high school, like I enrolled myself in a program. I, you know, read Beowulf. We had to memorize Hamlet, to be or not to be, da da da. But slowly but surely, poetry started getting into my bones, but I didn't read. And I was writing poetry before I actually sat down to put the time in, but I called myself a poet. And those words will never see the light of day, but I still have them. So it's like between my journaling, private journaling that I've been doing for over 25 years, and the poetry, somehow in zigzag ways, it came to me, introduced T.S. Eliot in a program I enrolled myself in again. Guidance counselor told me not to enroll myself because I was entering my senior year, and she was like, these kids have been in this program, and I did it anyway. Last year of high school, the Academy of Arts, and coming in contact with Langston Hughes. Again, I knew there were books of poetry, but I thought they belonged to people who were, like, either really super famous or super dead. Mm-hmm. Like Emily Dickinson. So I was like, oh, I'm not, like, so the idea of even, and I'm not embarrassed to tell this story. So a few years ago, when talking to my husband, who's also a poet, and I said, oh, yeah, I think I might want to put together a book, like maybe a chapbook. I don't know. And he was like, this is only maybe 3 years ago. Like, again, writing the whole time, right? And so he was like, okay. He was like, do you have like 40 to 50 poems for like a book collection? I was like, what? I was like, okay. So slowly like working towards it. I don't know. I climbed from under a rock. And it's funny because when I learned the idea of a Renaissance person, and I know this is some maybe like a faux pas thing to say, but when I started reading Victorian literature, I'm like, oh, I belong there, as long as I don't end up in the wrong place going back in time. But I belong there in a drawing room doing like really cool things. And like I would go towards what was drawing me, but then understanding that I still had to make a living, no one telling me that, like, I knew I couldn't return home. And alongside of that, still writing and doing my art and finding whatever found me. So zigzaggy path, I would say. And yeah. Even photography, same thing. Very zigzaggy.
You just come out with your first poetry book, and Mark's got a few under his belt. So I wanted to talk a little bit about the context of where the poems began. In particular, maybe that first poem that you wrote and you thought, okay, this is something you kind of feel that this is going to be something more. This is going to build into a book, perhaps, or you feel a spark of potential in that single poem and maybe a group of poems, and you start moving from there. But also I think the question is like the process of putting a book together, when does it start gelling into a sort of group of poems that constitute a book? Because it's a very specific changeover from writing poems to putting a manuscript together really deliberately. And I know there's lots of different examples you could give, but maybe your last book, for and your first book?
It's a great question, and I guess what I would say is that I've never written a book that's a quote unquote project, right? That's not how I think of poetry. It's not how I conceive of poems or why I like them. It's been 2 years ago. I chaired the jury for the National Book Award, which meant that I read every book of poems that had been published that year, you know, and for 2018, right? This was like 400, something around 400, and I read every single one of them in this very compressed period of time, and it was, you know, in some ways it like broke me, that process of, you know, I mean, that's a lot of poetry to read in a short amount of time, but on the other hand, it when I was finished with that process, I thought, you know what I actually really like? I really like individual poems. Mm-hmm. I like poems that are complete poems. I like poems that have this sort of ability to that can be read and that can stand alone. I've read and I love the sort of long book length things and novels and verse and, you know, all sorts of things like that. I read a lot and a lot of different things. But I realized what I wanted to do, I wanted to really write a poem that was a finished thing. I think of them, they're like objects. I think that they have, they take up space. They're sort of rooms you can enter into. And I just wanted, that's what I wanted to write. I think for every time I've written each of my books, I've just been writing poems, and I write poems during a period of time. What happens when you do that, if you do that consistently, what you begin to see are the concerns, your concerns. You begin to see what is preoccupying you. You begin to note and notice your obsessive vocabulary. You begin to see the kind of images that you keep going to, and it begins to kind of constellate, right? Like, here's this poem. And sometimes you'll write a poem that you think, well, this has nothing to do with anything. But it's your job is then to just keep going. Write another poem. Like, don't think about it too much. What you need to do is amass a certain amount, have some work in hand, and then stand back and begin to see what it is you've done, right? And then you can start to think, is there something missing from this? Is there something else I want to say? What am I worried about? What am I repeating? What is it that this is? Does there seem to be some kind of organizing principle? Am I writing things that are similar formally? What do these all sound like? And what I began to notice in this most recent book is that I was rhyming an awful lot. And one thing that I know is when I start to rhyme in a poem, it's a very kind of giddy experience. It drives the poem forward. The sound starts to kind of take over, and it's like composing music. Mm-hmm. It's that you begin to hear and anticipate something, and it's pulling you forward as you're writing that poem. That state for me is like an ecstatic state. It's a state that I want to occupy as many times in my life as I can. Like, I want to go back to that place all the time. It's why I keep writing. The other thing is, it's not that long. 2 years ago, I turned 50, and the day before my 50th birthday, I buried my father. It was, you know, and I felt like it was this moment in time when everything, you know, it's like I had one of those moments of reckoning where I thought, what am I going to do with the rest of my days? What do I want to do with the remaining energy of my life? Where do I want to push that? Where do I want that to go? How do I want to spend my time and with whom? You know, and I thought, the clock is ticking here. Like, there is not that much time left. And from that moment on, I thought, you know what? I need to write every day. Like, for as much as I can, my practice now needs to be a daily practice. I need to be working every day because I'm running out of time. So, you know, for me, collecting poems into a book is often about standing back and seeing what you've done in a certain period of time and then starting to think about how they cohere. Leaving enough open for accident. The problem with a project, per se, is like sometimes then you'll write a poem that's over here and you're like, well, that doesn't have anything to do with my project. Well, you know, you see, there are many, many books, and many of them that I've loved and, you know, very much, where someone is, you know, I'll use an example. It's, let's say someone wanted to write a book that uses the Salem witch trials as, you know, as a subject, and so that the poems are from maybe spoken in the voices of characters. And I think of that as a kind of project. It's one in which you have this sort of central organizing principle or subject, and that subject becomes kind of dominant, you know, in a way. It becomes the thing around which that whole, the book has to operate. But let's say that your dog finds a litter of kittens in a drainage ditch and you write a poem about it. That has nothing to do with the Salem witch trials. And so then you have to like take that poem and set it over here and be like, okay, well, there's just this thing that I wrote, you know, about this. But, and so I always think like, Let the totality, can the poem represent the totality of your experience at this point in time? Can the poem, I mean, can it, I feel like, for me, I want my poems to, my poems are about my subjectivity. They're coming out of the lived life. They're also, you know, going backwards in time, reflecting on things. They're also taking everything that I read and sort of trying to fashion from those things, trying to fashion a poem out of that. And what I want is freedom. You know, I've said this to some of my students before. If you can't be free in your life, at least be free in your poems. Mm-hmm. Like, I think of poems as places where I have imaginative freedom. I have freedom of association. I have freedom of to do and say, to be ugly. Yeah. I can be, you know, I also will tell my students, don't be the hero or the victim of your own poem. We are simultaneously the heroes and the victims all the time. And put yourself in between those poles.
Right,
like,
right.
Put yourself in between that. Endanger yourself a little bit in your poems. And but don't, like, it's not, a poem is not a place, for, I think, to declare, to make a kind of moral pronouncement. It's the place, I think it's the place where we explore moral, the ambiguity of our own experience and our own impulses.
Right.
And for me, that's where the interesting work often lies. It's that place where we're in between, where we are simultaneously a victim and a hero,
yep.
Where we can imagine ourselves in our complete human experience. Ugly, beautiful, profound, simple. That's what I want poems to be able to do. And sometimes they're, you know, I'm ugly in my poems and I say and do and think ugly things.
Right.
You know, that also needs to be part of it. That's what it is to be free, is to have all of that be possible. Anyway, long answer.
I think there's so much that you said that was really interesting of it. Just in terms of thinking about the project too, is it that, and I think it has to do with this freedom, is that when you sort of set out to do something with an intention, without letting a spontaneity happen with, you know, the authentic experience that you're having, and rather it's almost like you're trying to defend what you're doing before you've done it in order to say, I'm worthy of doing something.
I think a poem is a question, it's not an answer.
A poem is a question, not an answer.
That,
yeah.
A poem is a place in which you explore a question, and maybe you arrive at answers there, but you don't know them when you start it. It's
right.
It's like, I want to enter into the making of the poem from a place of unknowing, not a place of like, here's this thing I know, and I'm going to tell you this thing I know.
Mm-hmm.
I want it to be, I'm confused about this, so I'm going to start writing into this and see what unfolds,
mm-hmm.
and figure out what I think about something.
It's funny because I've done kind of both. Like, I'm one of those people. So I've been working on 3 to 4 different manuscripts at the same time. So I have this book, but I also have another book that just found a home, and that second poetry book is. See, I don't want to. I'm not going to call it a project. I entered into a conversation. And it was something, the conversation I entered into, I felt like it needed to happen. And I gave it time to have space away from me. And I still let poems and things, at the same time working on something I call memoir-esque, you know, let those things come to me as they needed to, and trying not to, what is it, like not letting the will do the work of the imagination, but also trying to say, well, okay, this was a very specific thing I wanted to engage with. Let's see how that plays out with this book. So in 2018, it was the 200th anniversary of Frankenstein. We did a write-in. We, myself, my husband, two other people, like, kind of locked ourselves in. Kind of, you know, minus being on some fancy lake in, like, Europe with, like, Lord Byron and, you know, Mary Shelley. They were missing, but they're with us in spirit. And so it was the first time I'd written poetry that was in some, like, fiction-ish. I don't know what's going on with that, but it's in its drawer just sleeping right now. But it was it was the first time I actually, the haunted space was where I grew up, but in my childhood, but in poetry. I'd done it in prose, and I have been working on it in prose. It was the first time that I allowed it, because it was almost like, without really thinking about it, I had organized it and said, okay, 280 Collins Street and ghetto claustrophobia, that's in prose. And for the record, like, ghetto claustrophobia, I always say it's the suburbs. It's, like, everywhere. It's not just, you know, dedicated to a group of people, hence the title poem. But in thinking about that, I was like, well, that, you know, for some reason before 2018, it was like, oh, that those stories are for, like, prose version. That's the prose version of it. And my poetry is for something else. And somehow, like, a veil had been pierced. And I looked and I was like, what did I come out of this? This is interesting. So slowly, as I was building toward having some kind of collection, didn't know what it was going to be. Didn't know what it was going to look like for this. I slowly just writing the poems, right, and letting them have a life. And then standing back and looking at it. But then this other project that I start, I hate to call it a project, but the conversation that I started was, I knew it was there and nagging at me and with me. Much like, I mean, Dark Goddess, which is photography, that I will put some words to eventually. It was with me for 6 years. Had not shot one picture for 6 years until late last year. Like, it was just hanging out. And it's almost like entering into these different conversations with different voices and, you know, and also not doing something. I'm working on another poetry thing, but not trying but not letting it, not saying, okay, every poem that I write has to go. I actually almost like do this thing, even with the second book, I just do this thing where I'm like, okay, I'm going to pretend that that's not the thing, and then go back to it. And then when I actually need to, because Bianca, you're right, there is, I don't know how it is for you, Mark, but it's like when you do enter, and almost like you have to remove yourself from it and you have to excavate or become some kind of anthropologist, or you step outside yourself and you're like, okay, some other person or entity came in and wrote all this and did all this. Now I have to step outside of whoever did that and put it together and see what it looks like. But then on top of that, my process always involved finding a group of readers who weren't just going to tell me, oh, this sounds nice, I like that. It's just like, okay, what do you mean by that? You know, tell me if something really doesn't stick. There's a whole section. I really wanted Louis XIV to be a ghetto claustrophobian. And somewhere he is. There's a whole little section of ghetto claustrophobians and the man in the iron mask and all that. Didn't make it into this book. So, and that's okay. Had a couple of readers. Darlings. Yeah, kill your darlings. My darlings are laying in a folder, hanging out. So, yeah, and there's, for me, it's like going back and forth between a switch, and I do agree. It's like you enter in with a sense of discovery, and sometimes you, maybe there's something you do want to be in conversation with and talk to, and that becomes the thing, but then still letting like a mystery unveil.
Yeah, I think it can be hard to when I think the worst thing it remind when I think of poetry projects, I think of applying for money to work on your poetry, and they're like, okay, so what's your project? And I'm like, I'm gonna write poems. And they're like, we're not gonna give you any money. It sucks. It sucks so hard. What is? Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, it is a sort of hybrid phenomenon, right? It's like PhDs are projects. You know, you're working towards your thesis and stuff. And I love that. I always talk about obsessions with my students, or I used to a lot of the time. And I always would be like, honor your obsessions and bring them into your poems. And poetry isn't like the sacred realm for only poetic subjects. Like, if you're interested in Star Trek, like, bring Star Trek into your poems. But, you know, it would be easy to be like, all right, well, I'm going to write a book of poetry that's all about Star Trek, you know, and there's something so limiting about that, because when you write that poem about your dog killing a pig, I don't even remember what you said, dog killing a pig, and you're like, but then it's like, okay, well, how can I fit that into my Star Trek book? Because, like, that's where my mind is, and, like, clearly the two exist simultaneously, and, like, that's okay, you know? Yeah.
Well, it was, you know, this question about it, the creative writing PhD, you know, I think, yes, that part of the pressure there is to be scholarly, you know, is to produce work that's scholarly. How do you produce scholarly work? You conduct research, right? What do you do with research? You know, then you write poems about this sort of subject that you're researching. It has to have that component. But the fact is that, you know, I think sometimes, like, the writing of poems is really dumb.
Yeah.
Like, it's like you're cultivating your own inner naivete, like your own ability to, like, not understand things necessarily. You know, it's much more, there's something, like, much more wonderfully primitive about it. It's like you're trying to draw up the id, and you're trying to sort of find the part, you know, where's the part of your psyche that's about urge as opposed to the intellect, right? As opposed to, like, the conceptual intellect. And so a poem is often this battle between it's a struggle between, you know, what we don't know, that which is associative, the part of our psyche that we don't understand, the id, you know, all of those things, and the conceptual intellect, which wants to solve problems and wants to put things in categories and wants to order things. That's what form is good for. If you give that part of your mind the job of managing form, mm-hmm. it's like got a job, and then the other part of your mind can kind of slip through and totally. Begin to kind of come through. So you have this other thing that is like compose, you know, writing down all the notes on as you compose the music, and then the other part is sort of being a little more wild. And occupying what I think of as that place of kind of ultimate freedom.
I think all writing should do that, though.
Well, the different genres require different, right? They require different parts of the brain to do different things. They have different functions, right? And they have different, like, something that you would be better served to write is prose. In a certain way, you know, if you really want to be clear about your story, you should probably write a nonfiction essay about, you know, or something like that. Whereas if you're feeling like there's too much ambiguity, there's too much unknown about what your story is, so to speak, like, poetry is more appropriate.
I'm thinking of someone who spent a lot of time in Vermont, Grace Paley, when she was once asked, what do you think a poet needs to do poems? And she said, a little indolence.
That's perfect.
And, you know, she was like, so when you're talking about, like, writing this, applying for money, and that what do you want to do? Well, I want to lie on my sofa. Right. Like, I want to lie on my couch for, like, a couple days and not have anything else to do. Like, that's what I really want. So, anyway.
I mean, it goes against our culture of, like, capitalism and factory working, and you must have a purpose, and you must have a job that makes money, and idle hands are the devil's plaything and stuff like that. But I think indolence is really crucial, and not having to, it's hard to intellectualize what you do. At the same time, I have so much fun dorking out about how poetry works and dorking out about poetry theory and all that. And, like, that's really fun for me to talk about. But actually, when it comes down to writing poetry, it's quite a different part of the brain that's working. I just did a meme where it was like, it was that starfish from SpongeBob, and he was like looking through a telescope. And it was like me when I'm talking about poetry. And then it was a picture of him with a hammer hammering a board into his head, and it was me when I'm writing poetry. It's like exactly what we're talking about, right? Yeah. Chantal, do you have anything to add to that?
No, I do. I do feel like, so I am one of those people that for a break, I'll jump into a documentary or something about the black hole or go straight into whatever. I'm that person. And at the same time, it's like still trying to hold, like, it's true. Like these fucking applications where you're just like, so what are you going to do? What's your focus? And you like, I'm really good at performing that and saying yes. And this and this and this and this and this. But what I really want to tell you is that I want to break into some abandoned places, which is, that's part of what I do. That I do that in real life. And I want to, and then other times I just want to sit somewhere and just, just stare. And like, I mean, it's, for me, the tension, cause I do sometimes research intensely and let things get in and then wait, think about, but you can't tell that. You can't like put that in it. It's a bullshitting. It's
bullshitting, yeah. You can get some money, and then you can
get some money. I mean, it's jacked. I mean, I have an MBA also, and so it's like, I'm somebody who went from women, gender, and sexuality for my undergrad and MBA, and so I also have that brain that's like, yeah, I can talk to you about the marketing and the strategy and the vision, da, da, da. And I'm also the person that wants to say, can I just tell you that I want to break into some shit? Can you fund me having caravans of people come with me break into shit, and that's what we're going to do? And so you're right. It's the bullshitting.
Yeah, it's just hard to learn the bullshit in that way. Okay, so we're wrapping it up. Thank you so much, both of you.
You.
Give another round of applause for these poets. Yeah.
Thank you again to Mark Wunderlich and Chantalie Gander for their poetry. And thank you to Walter Stone for the recording and the piano filler. See you next time.